And I do want to welcome you again to Christchurch Virginia Water. It's lovely to have you here, both regular congregation members here at Christchurch and many friends and guests from near and far. So thank you very much for joining us for this very special breakfast. And it is a delight for me to have Professor John Lennox with us, actually a colleague at Wycliffe Hall while I was there for 10 years. And John is sort of retired, of a sort. You'll notice from the bookstore I'll talk about in the back, but he's not terribly inactive, with a number of new titles appearing regularly. Much demand both at the Centre for Christian Apologetics in Oxford and speaking at events like this around the world. And it is delightful that you've made time to be with us, John, and really appreciate that, and particularly the way that you are passionate about explaining complex things in ways that the rest of us can understand, and we do very much appreciate that. And of course, our topic this morning is a very live one: the interface between Christianity and science, the common perception that I think you will soon hear disavowed, that it's incompatible to be a believer in God and to be a good scientist and committed to scientific means and methodology. And I think John will persuade you that those things are not necessarily incompatible. So without any further ado, I want to hand over to John. He's going to speak for a certain period of time, and then we're going to have opportunity for Q&A for you. So you might just want to be thinking about those questions as he speaks, and then we'll have a little bit of chance Q&A, opportunity to mingle a bit afterwards. I'll just mention now, but I'll say more about it at the end. There's a bookstall in the entrance area of the church on the way out, and there are a number of John's books there, including some very recent titles, but we'll touch on those briefly afterwards. Just in terms of practical housekeeping, if for any reason a fire alarm goes off or you need to evacuate the building urgently, then back out through the main entrance you came in would be the most obvious exit. There's also a fire exit out that way as well, and we would reassemble back in the front of the church as necessary. And we also have a third exit out through the vestry door there also. So let me just pray and ask God to be with us as we go into this time together. Father God, thank you so much for the privilege we have of meeting here in your name. We pray, Lord, for our brother and friend, John, as he speaks this morning. Please grant him clarity and insight into this contemporary and complex topic of science and faith. And pray, Lord, that we would all learn new things today and also grow in our understanding and trust of you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you so much for your invitation, and thank you for coming at this ungodly hour of a Saturday morning. I've been asked to speak on the title, Can Science Explain Everything? And in a way, this is an inaugural talk, because I wasn't aware that my new book, Can Science Explain Everything?, would be delivered here today, because it's not due to be in the shops until January. So I'm highly delighted, and thanks to the bookshop for organizing that. It's, as Simon has said, it's a very common thing for people to think that science gives us all the explanations, and that God is neither necessary nor relevant, nor even... Can we... There's a lot of echo here, so can we sort that before I go on? There is this very strong feeling that science explains everything and there's no need for God or anything else. And I'm interested in this. One of the main reasons is what happened to me very early on in my time as a student at Cambridge. I was sitting at dinner and found myself beside a Nobel Prize winner. I'd never met one before. And I tried to think what questions I could ask, because in my life I've discovered it's much easier to ask questions than to answer them. And so I play Socrates as a matter of deliberate habit. And I started talking to him, and I tried to approach the God question. And the nearer I got to it, the more uncomfortable he became. So being a kind Irishman, I backed off. And I thought that was the end of it. He turned to his neighbour and so on. But at the end of the dinner, he said, "Lennox, come to my room." And the sound of his voice didn't exactly appeal to me. But I went to his room, and he invited two or three other senior members of the university, no students, and they put me on a chair and stood around me. And then he said this, "Lennox, do you want a career in science?" I said, "Yes, sir." "Well," he said, "in front of witnesses this evening, give up this naive belief in God. It will only cripple you intellectually. You'll never make it. You will suffer by comparison with your peers. And God is entirely irrelevant to the scientific endeavor. So give it up." I'd never known pressure like that. And he had won a Nobel Prize. I couldn't help thinking, of course, subsequently, that if he'd been a Christian and I'd been an atheist, he would have lost his job the next day. And that put steel into my mind and heart, and it made me resolve that if ever I had the opportunity to do what I'm doing this morning, that is to discuss these things in public, I would never browbeat people. I would try and give them evidence that they could think about, and I would trust them to be able to make up their own mind. And that's what I've tried to do for most of my life. So that's a little bit of my history, why I became utterly committed to undermine this force majeure attitude within some sections of academia, to simply browbeat people by powerful voices saying that you cannot believe in God. Now, a very famous example of the attitude that science explains everything is Bertrand Russell's famous statement, which he didn't completely believe, actually, but that's another story. "Whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific methods, and what science cannot discover, mankind cannot know." It sounds a very strong statement, but actually it is logically incoherent. Russell was a famous mathematician, a brilliant historian and philosopher and logician, but when he wrote that, his logic departed him. And even at this time on a Saturday morning, you can see why. Because that statement is not a statement of science, and therefore we cannot know it. So if it's true, it's false. Have you got that? Or is that a bit too complex for a Saturday morning? This is logically incoherent. It's a typical example of going too far. It's like the person that comes and tells you, as many do today, in this connection, "Well, there is no such thing as absolute truth." But they're claiming that what they've just said is absolute truth. That there is no such thing as absolute truth. These are logically incoherent statements, and they need to be analysed very carefully. Well, Russell lived a long time ago. Stephen Hawking only recently died. And Stephen was a genius. I remember him walking around Cambridge using a stick because the motor neuron disease had only just started. And he had a formidable reputation even then, which he substantiated ever since. He was a few years ahead of me, but he's light years ahead of me in his mathematical prowess and brilliance. And he wrote this book, The Grand Design, which title is very interesting because it tells me that Hawking saw that there was a grand design. But he had to deal with it some way, because this is the book where he declares his atheism. And this book is devoted to big questions. How can we understand the world in which we find ourselves? How does the universe behave? What is the nature of reality? Where did all this come from? Did the universe need a creator? Why do we exist? Why this particular set of laws and not some other? Why is there something rather than nothing? Now, Hawking took Russell's view that science was the way to truth, and we'll see that in a moment. But the interesting thing is, here are his questions with which he starts his book. How many of them can be tackled using science? Only one of them. It's interesting, isn't it? Only that question, how does the universe behave, of that entire list can be dealt with scientifically. All the others are philosophical questions, or if you like, theological questions. So his very list of questions belies what he next says. Traditionally, he says, these questions in that list are questions for philosophy, but philosophy is dead. It has not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly in physics. As a result, now note this carefully, scientists have become the bearers of the torch of discovery in our quest for knowledge. This again is Russell's view. Science explains everything. Science is the torch bearer for truth. Now we have a word for that. We call it scientism. It's not science, but it's the view that science is the only way to truth. But look at that carefully. Traditionally, these are questions for philosophy. Well, of course they are, because all of them except one are philosophical questions. But now he says philosophy is dead, and the Department of Philosophy at Cambridge was not particularly pleased with that assertion. And he got into a huge amount of trouble, and many people pointed out the irony of that statement, because it comes at the beginning of a book on what topic? The philosophy of science. So here's Hawking writing a book on the philosophy of science, starting it by saying philosophy is dead. Now, I'm going to be a little bit critical of Stephen Hawking, so please don't misunderstand me. He was a genius. His mathematics and his work on black holes, and I wish he'd got the Nobel Prize. If somebody had only discovered Hawking radiation, he would have won it. So there's no question about that. But it's when he moves into the philosophical area that we've problems. It was Einstein, no less, who said that the scientist is a poor philosopher. Now, I have to watch this, because I'm sitting here as a mathematician, and I'm moving over into philosophy. So you need to apply what I'm saying to myself. In the lead-up to the funeral of Stephen Hawking, our Astronomer Royal made what I regard as a very courageous statement about Stephen Hawking. Now, they were close friends. And Lord Rees said something like this. He said, you know, I know Stephen very well, and he knows very little philosophy and no theology, and we should not listen to a word he says on either of these topics. Now, that is quite a remarkable statement within academia, but it brings me to a very important yet very simple point. Not every statement by a scientist is a statement of science. But the problem is that people like Hawking have, rightly, a huge scientific authority. And therefore, when they speak, everything is an authoritative statement of science when it isn't. See, this is not a statement of science. So we need to go into this cautiously and carefully. And we come now to the heart of it. One cannot prove that God doesn't exist. That's honest and that's important. But science makes God unnecessary. In what context? In the context of explanation. Remember, our title is, Can Science Explain Everything? The laws of physics can explain the universe without the need for a creator. And here's the key argument of the book. Don't worry so much about the first bit. The second sentence there is, because there is a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Now, when I first saw that, I thought, what's going on there? Here's the explanation of it. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing. That's one of Hawking's big questions. Why is there something rather than nothing? Well, here's the answer according to him. Why the universe exists, why we exist, that's another of his big questions. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. So science explains it. There's been a and therefore God is unnecessary. But let's look more carefully at it. This, as I say, key argument of his book. Because there is a law like gravity, that is, because there is something, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Flat contradiction. It is a straight contradiction. And I was amazed when I noticed that, because you see, neither gravity nor a law of gravity is nothing. And interestingly, he says because there is a law, not because gravity exists. And one begins to wonder, is he actually suggesting that laws like gravity are creative? Somewhat in the vein of another brilliant physicist, Paul Davis, there's no need to invoke anything supernatural in the origins of the universe or of life. I've never liked the idea. This is not a really scientific way of speaking, by the way. I have never liked the idea of divine tinkering. Notice the pejorative use of the word tinkering. It's not divine activity or input, it's tinkering. For me, it is much more inspiring to believe that a set of mathematical laws can be so clever as to bring all these things into being. Much more inspiring, but you're being inspired by nonsense. I once had a little, I suppose you could call it an interchange of ideas with Peter Atkins, who's a notorious atheist at Oxford. And he'd just been in a debate, and I got talking to him, and I said, Peter, what do you think created the universe? He said, mathematics. And he caught me, so I'm afraid I was rude, I started to laugh. And that isn't really always the way to make friends. he said, what are you laughing at? Well, I said, Peter, let me be honest with you, because I am a mathematician, and that's the silliest thing I've heard for a long time. He said, why? Well, I said, let me make it simple. 1 + 1 = 2. Did that equation ever put £2 in your pocket? Doing mathematics doesn't create money. That was one of the problems in the financial crisis, you know, ladies and gentlemen. There were some very clever mathematicians who thought that doing mathematics created money. You need to beware of mathematicians, you see, for that reason. And C.S. Lewis got it beautifully years ago when he pointed out that the laws of nature are descriptions. So 1 + 1 = 2, yes. But if you want to get £2, you have to get a pound and add them together. Mathematics, even if you do it from now to eternity, will not do it for you. The laws are not creative. In fact, the laws of nature don't cause anything. Newton's laws of motion, the famous laws of motion, never moved a billiard ball in the history of the universe. It's people with cues that do that. The laws describe in existence. And that is crucially important because of this huge confusion about the nature of law. But worse still, let's go on. The universe will create itself. What would you make of that? Well, if it creates itself, it must already be in existence. So you have a flat nonsense statement there. What about nothing? Well, it'll create itself from nothing, he claims. Now, nothing has become extremely interesting. I must confess to you, I now give lectures because it's such an intriguing topic. It really is. Because in order, now let's go back to the big question. You see, the big question that faces every thinking person is, as Leibniz, the mathematician, put it long ago, why is there something rather than nothing? That was in the list. Do you remember that? Hawking claims to have answered it. And here's his answer. The universe will create itself from nothing. Well, that is, first of all, a nonsense statement. But we need to analyze what does he mean by nothing. Because you discover it isn't nothing. It's a quantum vacuum or it's something like that. And I fortunately get opportunities to debate in public with some of the most prominent scientists of the world. And on one occasion, I was invited to the Harvard MIT Faculty Club, and I've never faced such a formidable array of scientists. And I was debating with Alan Guth, who is rated as the number one cosmologist in the world today, the father of the theory of inflation and so on. Now, after we'd finished, I did what I've never done before or since. I said, can I ask the first question? So I said, Alan, you know, out there in the public, there is much ado about nothing. Because I said, look, Alan, when you use the word nothing in this kind of context, do you mean nothing in the sense in which all of us mean it, absence of anything? He said, no, I do not. I said, thank you very much. Let's see another attempt at defining nothing. This is why I say it gets fun, because here's another cosmologist, and you'll see that, oh, okay, I haven't quoted him, so I'm going to quote him without the slide. There's a famous cosmologist called Lawrence Krauss, and I have tangled with him. That's the only way to describe it. I've tangled with him several times on air. And in his book, A Universe from Nothing, he says, surely nothing is every bit as physical as something, especially if you define it as the absence of something. What? Surely nothing is every bit as physical as something, especially if you define it as the absence of something. That's on about page 5 of his book. It is utter nonsense. And what disturbs me, ladies and gentlemen, is because of their authority as scientists, people buy into it. When they're talking absolute nonsense. Oh, there it is up there. How did it appear there? It's Mike came out of nothing, you see. So we're in a difficulty. Do you see where the difficulty comes from? Science caught up with the Bible after several thousand years. The Bible, of course, has been saying that the universe started, it came into being. In the beginning, God created. But science only got there in the 1960s when they started to believe that there was a beginning. But if there was a beginning, there was nothing. So now the problem, how do you get something from nothing? And the attempts are becoming extremely ludicrous and bizarre. And that concerns me because some of our leading people are using their brain power in science and their authority simply to bamboozle the rest of us that they've answered the question. Well, they haven't really begun to address it. So I've formulated this, nonsense remains nonsense even if scientists say it. Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize winner in physics, once said this, and I always think of this when I'm giving a lecture. He said, outside his or her field, the scientist is just as dumb as the next person. So that's from another Nobel Prize winner, and I've already made that statement. Here's a much more measured view by Lord Winston. Science is not about certainty. Science is about probability. Science is not about absolutes. We scientists give the impression that science is about the truth. It's not. It's about what is most likely. Now, that's a much more humble position, and it's very different from the positions we've been representing up until now. Sir Peter Medawar wrote a book. He was another Nobel Prize winner in Oxford, and he wrote a book on the limits of scientists. It's a book directed at young scientists, and all of us should read it. That there is indeed a limit upon science. Now remember our title, Can Science Explain Everything? No, says Medawar. That there's a limit upon science is made very likely by the existence of questions that science cannot answer, and that no conceivable advance of science would empower it to answer. These are the questions that children ask, the ultimate questions of Karl Popper, such as, how did everything begin? And here come some of Hawking's questions again. What are we all here for? What is the point of living? And Medawar added to that, we need to turn away from the natural sciences to philosophy and religion to get any sort of answer to these questions. So where have we got to? The claim that is very much in the public eye, science can explain everything, but there are brilliant scientists who says, no, it can't. It certainly can't. So here are some things that science cannot explain. The first might surprise you. It can't explain mathematics and logic. Why? Because it depends on them. That's a very simple argument, isn't it? But it works. Simple arguments aren't always wrong, you know. Secondly, it cannot explain values and ethical beliefs. Einstein once says, you can talk about the ethical foundations of science. You cannot talk about the scientific foundations of ethics. Aesthetic experience. Well, consciousness, all of these things are complete mysteries to contemporary science. And in a sense, science cannot explain itself. Why does science work? How does it work? Those are not scientific questions, they're philosophical questions. So in fact, all the most important and interesting questions science cannot deal with. And therefore, we need to focus on them. So let's go back and ask another question about science. Where does modern science come from? And you immediately think of the great pioneers like Galileo, Kepler, Newton. Euler, by the way, is a mathematician. I had to have at least one in there. And Clerk Maxwell, the Scottish Einstein, as he's known. And you see, Maxwell, the last of those, was an absolute genius. And on the door of the most famous physics lab in the world, Cavendish at Cambridge, you can still read the words, "Great are the works of the Lord, to be studied by all who take delight in them." For the fact is that those pioneers, and many others as well, including the father of computing, Babbage, were all believers in God. Indeed, the majority Christian. Now, what does that tell us? Well, it tells us very clearly that their faith in God didn't hinder their science a bit. And in fact, it was the motor that drove it. Let's listen. This is C.S. Lewis summarizing the famous historian and philosopher of science, Sir Alfred North Whitehead. Whitehead points out that centuries of belief in a God who combined the personal energy of Jehovah with the rationality of a Greek philosopher first produced that firm expectation of systematic order which rendered possible the birth of modern science. Men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a legislator, a lawgiver. In other words, there's a deep resonance between science and Christian theism. And the bottom quote is by a brilliant philosopher called Alvin Plantinga. And he says the alleged conflict between science and theism is superficial. And he goes on to say the alleged concord between science and atheism is superficial. And we shall come on to that a little bit later. So a deep connection historically between the rise of modern science and Christianity. In fact, there's been a thesis produced by Oxford's second professor of science and religion that maintains that it wasn't only theism, the belief that there is a creator, that shaped modern science. It was specifically the attitude of the reformers to scripture that produced it. And his thesis has been taken very seriously because the reformers said, let's look and see what scripture says. Let's not impose upon it some kind of mystical or allegorical interpretation, as was very common for many years. And similarly, the scientists said, let's just look at what the universe is telling us without imposing on it some preconceived idea like all perfect motion is circular, coming from Aristotle, that held up scientific research for centuries. So there is that deep connection. And that raises a related question. You see, if faith in God taught Galileo and Newton and so on that it's worth investigating the universe because there's a rational creator behind it, and indeed doing this work will be a form of worship, then we have to ask, worldview, Christian worldview, shaped the rise of science. Where is the conflict? Is it really between science and religion, as people say? And this is one of my big points for this morning. It's not. The alleged conflict is between science and religion. The actual conflict is not. It's between worldviews. Now, look at those two people. They're both Nobel Prize winners in physics, Steven Weinberg and Charles Townes. What's the difference between them? Well, not scientifically. They're both the Nobel Prize. You can't go higher than that. But Weinberg's an atheist and Townes a believer. So what separates them is their worldview. Now let me put it this way. The conflict that's in our society today is between worldviews, and there are scientists on both sides. Exactly as there are there. That single picture ought to give the lie to the idea that science and religion are in conflict. So now let's focus down on this. Here we have Isaac Newton believed in God, and he gave us the law of gravitation. And we've just seen that Stephen Hawking uses the law of gravitation to say there isn't a God. Now that, when I noticed it, became extremely interesting. How do you move from one to the other? And I want to suggest to you that here are the reasons. It's not a result of scientific advance between Newton's day and ours. It's a result of one false logic, two false ideas about the nature of God, and three false ideas about the nature of scientific explanation. Now, we've dealt with the false logic. And just let me remind you, before we look at the others, what the biblical view of this creation of the universe is. First of all, the universe is not made from anything physical, but it's not come from nothing. God is not nothing, but God is not physical. God is spirit, according to the Bible. And that turns the modern naturalistic conception on its head, because these days mass energy is the basic stuff, or if I were to be more accurate, nothing is the basic stuff. Do you realize that in our contemporary society, the choice we now have to make for why there is something rather than nothing is God or nothing? Either nothing becomes everything on its own spontaneously, or there is a God who created it. So it's God or nothing you have to choose between, which I never thought I'd live to see. We've seen That's your choice this morning, God or nothing. Here's an astronomer who's got a very different view from Hawking. This man did win the Nobel Prize. Astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which is created out of nothing, one with a very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the right conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan. That's the man who discovered that set up the whole idea that there was a beginning. So we've got very different views at the top. And the reason is it science? No, it's their world view. Now, my second point, I took a long time to catch this, that one of the reasons Hawking rejects God, not only as unnecessary, but he doesn't believe God exists, is because he's not talking about the biblical God. It took a long time for me to realize that many of the colleagues I spoke to, when I use the word God, they think of something like the Greek god of lightning. And the Greek god of lightning is made unnecessary and non-existent by advances in science. This is one of the gods that science gets rid of, and rightly so. You see this cartoon on the left, there's a big bunch of mathematics and then a gap and another bunch of mathematics. And in the middle it says, then a miracle occurs. And one scientist says to the others, I think you need to be a bit more explicit in step two. And that is the view of many people. As far as I can see, Dawkins and Hawking and a number of other people I've debated, they believe that I believe the gaps. I can't follow the logic of that. If you define God to be the explanation for what science has not yet explained, then of course you have to choose between God and science as a matter of logic. But you see, the God of the Bible is not a God of the gaps. Have you ever read the first few words in the Bible? They go like this, just let me remind you of them. In the beginning, God created the bits of the universe we don't yet understand. That is what so many people in our society believe. And so, as understanding grows, those bits disappear. So God disappears, like a smile on the face of a Cheshire cat. But the God of the Bible is the God of the whole show. That is the God who created everything, the bits we do understand and the bits we don't. Now, here's the interesting thing. It's bits we do understand that point the finger towards him. See, Isaac Newton, gravity, he didn't say, now I've got a law of gravity, I don't need God. This is really what Hawking say. We've got gravity, we don't need God. Newton didn't say, we've got gravity, we don't need God. No, he wrote a book which he dedicated to people, hoping that the sheer wonder of what he discovered in the laws that governed the universe would lead thinking people to believe in God. And that's the way your mind works, isn't it? The more you know about art, the more you can admire the genius of Rembrandt, not the less. The more you know about engineering, the more you can admire the genius of a Rolls Royce, to take that German motor car. you're still awake, that's very good. But you see the point, that we admire, and the more Newton, and to my very limited extent, the more I understand the workings of the universe, the more I say, just, that's genius. And that is a spontaneous reaction to looking up at the night sky. That sense of sheer wonder that there is something behind it. So, come to the next point. We're talking about, can science explain everything? Let's push this. What can science explain? Well, the law of gravity. What does it explain? Well, I'm afraid I was taught at school, should I confess this? I'm afraid I was taught at school that the law of gravity explained gravity. It doesn't. That was such a shock when I learned that in my late teenage. The law of gravity does not explain gravity. Newton realized that. He made a famous statement about it. Non fingo hypothesi. I do not feign hypotheses. That is, I do not pretend to understand gravity. I've given you an equation, and you can use it brilliantly to calculate the effect of this gravitational force between heavy bodies, and so you can work out the trajectory of the planets around the sun. But no idea what gravity is, and you know, nobody has today. There are so many things that we don't know. What's that telling us? Law of gravity gives us a description, an ability to do calculations, but it doesn't explain gravity. So even within science, you need to watch the word explanation, because it is usually only partial, even within science. Now, these ideas will be for some people new, because they're not used to exploring any further what explanation means. But let's take a very simple example of explanation. Why is the water boiling? Well, because the heat energy from the gas flame is agitating the molecules of water in the kettle. That's why it's boiling. Is it? Well, actually, it's boiling because I want a cup of tea. Now, your laughter tells me something, because I'm making a foolish statement. I've given you two explanations of the boiling water, right? One is a scientific. The other is in terms of personal agency and volition. I want a cup of tea. Do those explanations conflict? No. Do they compete? No. They complement. And finally, which is the most interesting of the two explanations? Well, people have been drinking tea for thousands of years before they knew anything about heat equations. Do you see the point? Why can some scientists not see that at the bigger level? Science explains everything. A simple matter of boiling water doesn't. It clearly doesn't. And sometimes I speak in schools, you see, and I put this to kids, and even a 10-year-old will put up her hand and say, "Sir, you need both explanations." Exactly. And we need to see that at the bigger level. Let me put it this way. Newton's law of gravitation no more competes with God as an explanation of the universe than the law of internal combustion competes with Henry Ford as an explanation for the motor car. You need both. You see, this whole business of pitching God against science is so fatally flawed and wrong, because God is not the same kind of explanation as science. That's the crucial thing. Science is mainly dealing with how it works. God is the explanation why there is a universe in which science can be done. Does that make sense to you? It's dead simple. In fact, I find that most of the important arguments in this area are very simple matters of common sense logic. You don't have to have advanced degrees in science to understand them. So what we've got to is explanation. Can science explain everything? No, it can't. It's limited, and we can see it's limited because there are different kinds of explanation. And the scientific explanation doesn't rule God out any more than the science of automobile engineering rules Henry Ford out. But now let's probe a little bit further. What do we do science with? Now, I have lots of fun with my colleagues putting questions to them. As I say, it's easier to ask questions than answer them. So I say to someone, "What do you do science with?" And I point to my head so as they don't go down the wrong direction and tell me about their latest $1 billion piece of laboratory equipment. Oh, they say to me, you mean, and they're about to use the word mind when they remember that it's not politically correct to believe in the mind these days. So they say, my brain. Well, I say, okay, I believe that the mind story is different from the brain story, and so on. I can tell you, if I'm a certain kind of neuroscientist, what's in your brain electrically. I can't tell what's in your mind. You can tell me what's in your mind, but you can't tell me what's in your brain. They're different stories. But anyway, okay, I'll go with that. Tell me about your brain. How did the brain come to be? The really short story of the brain, a brief history of the brain, if you like. Well, the brain is the end product of a mindless, unguided process. Oh, I say. And you trust it. Tell me, if you knew that your computer was the end product of a mindless, unguided process, would you trust it? And I always have forced the answer, and I've always got the answer, no. And then I say, I see you have a problem. You're doing science with an instrument whose origin you wouldn't trust in any other area. That's a very curious state of affairs, isn't it? And there's a big history behind it. They sometimes look at me and say, they say I'm not clever enough to think of arguments like that. So they say, where did you get it from? And I said to one just the other day, you'll never believe where I got the argument from. Try me. I got it from Charles Darwin. Never. Oh, yes. With me, the horrid doubt always arises. Notice the word always. Whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, as he believed, are of any value or at all trustworthy. And he goes on to say, what would you make of the convictions of a monkey's mind if there are such convictions in such a mind? Now remember what I was saying, that there's an alleged conflict between science and belief in God. But it's superficial. I'm now about to argue that there's an alleged concord between science and atheism, but there's actually a very deep conflict, and it's coming. You see, it's not only Christians that are referred to this. Thomas Nagel is one of the world's most distinguished philosophers, and on the top there you'll see one of the most provocative titles of any book that's been published in my lifetime. Now, this is a hard atheist. What do I mean by that? He doesn't want there to be a God. And he puts that in writing. He writes the book, Mind and Cosmos, Why the Neo-Darwinian View of the World is Almost Certainly False. Now, if you want to see the debate that that unleashed, it covers endless gigabits on the internet. And in that book, he refers to Darwin's doubt in this way. If the mental is not itself merely physical, it cannot be fully explained by physical science. Evolutionary naturalism implies that we shouldn't take any of our convictions seriously, including the scientific world picture on which evolutionary naturalism itself depends. In other words, you see, what atheism does as a logical consequence is undermine the validity of the very rationality we need, not only for science, but any thinking whatsoever. And C.S. Lewis pointed it out, that no theory can be valid that invalidates human thinking because it has been reached by thinking. Very simple point. He said it long ago. But now even atheist philosophers are pointing out that there's something seriously wrong with the idea, A, that science explains everything, but that everything's reducible to physics and chemistry, because it isn't. But all this has been God talk, you see, so far. But what about science and Christianity specifically? I mean, do they mix? How will they cope? Can science explain everything in Christianity? Well, we've just seen that science can't explain everything. That's a non-starter. And serious scientists just don't believe it. But the public have been sold it by very strong people like Hawking. But now, let's have a look here, because you see, what happens very often is people listen to me talk about these things, and they're very polite. And they say, well, that's all very interesting. But you know, I have a basic problem with you. Well, I say, what is your basic problem? Well, all this argument from philosophy and the nature of science and the nature of explanation, it's all very convincing, but you can't get out of the fact that you're a Christian and not a mere theist. And I confess that to you. You may have just noticed that I am a Christian. I am a Christian. And I remember very frequently I get challenged with this kind of thing. How can you possibly believe in the central claim of the Christian faith, A, that God became human, and B, that Christ proved it by being raised from the dead? Because, after all, that conflicts with all we know of science. So you might have some divine mind away out there. That's fine by me. But please, it's a bit like Paul Davis. I don't believe in God tinkering and getting involved if there is a God. But here's the central thing of Christianity. The first fact of the history of Christendom is a number of people who say they've seen the resurrection. If they died without making anyone else believe this gospel, no gospels would ever have been written. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Jesus rose from the dead. Are miracles a step too far in a scientific age, even if science doesn't explain everything? So, here's Hawking again. Scientific determinism is the basis of all modern science. And it's this he uses to exclude miracles. So if we involve God, the real crunch comes with the question, are there miracles exceptions to the laws? This book is rooted, that's the grand design, is rooted in the concept of scientific determinism, which implies that the answer is that there are no miracles, no exceptions to the laws of nature. And that is a huge argument, and it goes back to the Scottish Enlightenment philosopher David Hume, who wrote this. A miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, and as a firm and unalterable experience established these laws, the proof against a miracle from the very nature of the fact is as entire as any argument from experience can be imagined. Exit miracles. And when I did a debate with Christopher Hitchens, he said to me, look, Hume has said the last word about miracles. And I said, rather cheekily, Christopher, he hasn't. And in fact, he was entirely wrong about miracles. And afterwards, he said to me, that was a bit heavy, that stuff about Hume. I said, it was, but it was true. I said, you got your stuff from Dawkins, didn't you? He said, yes. Well, I said, I'd be careful what I took from Dawkins on Hume, because he was wrong. Now, why do I say that, ladies and gentlemen? Well, because I got to know Anthony Flew towards the end of his life. He lived in Reading, was professor of philosophy, and who in his day had the same reputation as Dawkins, as being a dyed-in-the-wool intellectual atheist. But in high old age, Anthony Flew became a believer in God. And the reason was to do with the nature of explanation. And I haven't mentioned this bit, But it's very simple to mention. We're often taught at school and university that the only valid kind of explanation is when you explain a complex thing in terms of simple things. But you see, that is true in many fields, but it's not true when there is language involved. You're looking at a slide, there's language on it, not much language. Just take the first two words. You know intuitively that there's a mind behind that slide. Whatever physical processes, and there are many being involved in letting you see it, there's a mind behind it. Because you understand it's linguistic. And that's the problem, of course. We have lived to discover the longest word. It's a chemical word. It's the human DNA code with over 3 billion letters in it in the right order. Fascinating. And Flew came to see that you can't have code language to that extent without a mind. So he came to believe in the mind of God. And I asked him about David Hume. Ah, he said, and it was so honest. I was deeply moved, actually. I was wrong about you. I said, seriously. He said, I was wrong. He said, the sad thing is, I'd have to rewrite all my books, and I never will. Because he died just a short time afterwards. What was he wrong about? Because the first statement there is false. Think about it. Now, just imagine I'm staying in a hotel at the moment, which I'm not. I'm in a much more delightful place than a hotel. But think I'm staying in a hotel. And last night I put £100 into a drawer by my bed. And tonight I put another £100. And tomorrow I open the drawer and I find 50 quid in it. Now, what do I conclude? Do I conclude that the laws of arithmetic have been broken? Or that the laws of England have been broken? Have you got it? I conclude that the laws of England have been broken. Apart from my wife taking some out for shopping. But we'll leave that aside. Okay. I conclude that the laws of England have been broken. How do I know that the laws of England have been broken? Because the laws of arithmetic have not been broken. Do you see that? It's my knowledge that the laws of England weren't violated, the laws of arithmetic weren't violated, that tells me that the laws of the country were violated. And that's the confusion. The laws of mathematics and nature are not like the laws of a country. There's a double use of the word law that brings great confusion here. Do you see that? You see, the interesting thing is, and Lewis points this out, that unless you know the laws of nature, you would never recognize a miracle if you saw one. I mean, if people were always popping up out of tombs all over the place, you would think nothing special about it. But because you know it doesn't regularly happen, you recognize something very special to do with Jesus Christ. Now, what is the point here? The point is that we have two things, not one. What was my mistake in my view of the drawer in my room? My mistake was to think it was a closed system of cause and effect. And that nobody could put their hand in. And that is the position of many materialist and naturalistic thinkers today. They think our universe is a closed system of cause and effect. It created itself. But it isn't, you see. And how do we know it isn't? Because, you see, the laws of nature can only tell you that resurrections are improbable. It cannot say they're impossible. You see. And once you realize that the laws of nature are utterly necessary to recognize miracles. So what we've got is a God who's created a universe with certain regularities which we recognize so that we can use our knowledge of them, not our ignorance of them. And Hume was dead wrong there. He said, you know, in the New Testament days, people were primitive. They could believe in miracles easily. That's absolute nonsense. When Mary came to Joseph, and it's Christmas time, so we'll be thinking about that, and said she was pregnant, what did Joseph do? He wanted to divorce her. Why? Because he knew exactly where babies came from, as much as a modern gynecologist. It took a tremendous amount of divine pressure and intervention to convince him that this was an act of God's supernatural power. And you see, coming back to the resurrection, if I were telling you that Jesus rose from the dead by natural processes going on in the tomb just before it happened, then that would violate the laws of nature, but I'm not. The biblical claim is that God raised Jesus from the dead by an input of colossal power. So, Hume moves out of the way and opens the possibility that the resurrection happened. But now we have to ask, how do we know it happened? And I'm coming very near the end, and I'm glad we're in this church, because I know that the vicar, Dr. Vibert, will from time to time be explaining to you exactly what the evidence is. But here's the heart of it. You see, science is evidence-based. One of the great confusions of our society is Christianity is a matter of faith. Science is a matter of evidence. Totally wrong. Science is a matter of faith and evidence. Christianity is a matter of evidence and faith. Faith is not a religious word that means, according to Dawkins, believing where there's no evidence. Faith is an ordinary word coming from fides, trust, reliability, confidence. And if you trust anybody or any statement without asking for evidence, you're rather foolish. You'll find your bank manager will not play along with that if you go for a loan. Would you give me a loan, Mr. Bank Manager? Yes. On what basis should I give it to you? Well, just trust me. Well, what's your collateral? Well, don't worry about that. Just trust me. That's blind faith, ladies and gentlemen. And Jesus doesn't ask for blind faith. Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so you may believe. Here's the evidence. If Christianity were not evidence-based, we wouldn't need the New Testament. So that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And here's the last crunch question. Does it really work? And you see the claim, you may have life in his name. See, one of the big reasons I sit here is not because I'm a scientist and sorted out all the arguments. That's only part of it. It's because I've seen that happen, not only in my life, but in the life of hundreds of others. I meet someone, and I never forget. Let me tell you a little story. May I tell you a story? I was speaking at Harvard to several thousand students. You can see it on the internet. And when I'd finished my talk, a Chinese student stood up on the balcony. It was absolutely packed. And he shouted to the whole crowd, "Just look at me." And of course we did. And we all looked at him. And he was obviously looking towards me. And I said, "Why should we look at you?" He said, "6 months ago, I heard you speak in another university in the United States." And he said, "My life was in a total mess. I couldn't see any way out. I was in absolute despair. And something you said stuck. And I began to explore. And I started to read the New Testament. And I became a Christian. Just look at me." And he was radiant. It was one of the most powerful demonstrations. You see, ladies and gentlemen, let me put it to you practically. If I meet a person, and this has happened many times, and perhaps their relationships are all askew, perhaps they're on drugs or they're alcohol dependent, they see no way out, they may even have suicidal tendencies, or their life is just generally without meaning. I speak to dozens of people and find they don't really have any peace if they're honest. They feel a weight of guilt and they don't know how to handle it and all this kind of stuff. And then I see them 6 months later and the alcohol or drugs have been turned into food on the table. The marriage is back on course or the relationship's re-established. And I say, what has happened to you? And they say something like, well, I met Christ or I became a Christian. Or they may phrase it in a dozen different ways. When you see that constantly through life, I can add two and two, you know, and get four. And you see, in science, and I was challenged not long ago by a questioner who said, look, you can't be a scientist and a Christian because in science, everything's testable. In Christianity, nothing is. I said, who told you that? And I told them what I've just said to you. Of course it's testable. That's one of the thrilling things that gives me the confidence to sit here. You can test it. Because Christ has promised that if we turn our backs on the mess we've made of our own lives and the lives of others, if we're honest, and trust him as the one who gave himself for us on the cross, nobody else has done that, and rose again, then we'll be given forgiveness, peace, deep peace with God. And not only that, a new power to live. I find that is very powerful stuff. You see, Christianity has got an objective side, all the arguments we've talked about. But in the end, it's got a subjective side. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. But I want to hear your questions, so thank you so much for listening.
Well, John, we're just recovering. It was just amazing, as we expect, and we could listen to you all day, I'm sure. We are gonna finish at 11:30. I want to give you an opportunity to browse the bookstore on the way out, and particularly to pick up this book, which we have today, which even John was impressed that his book was here today. So thank you so
very
much.
Impressed.
And there's several others of John's books, and he's happy to hover there and to take your questions and to sign the book. But before we go, I'm sure that what you've heard has raised a few questions in your mind. There are a couple of roving mics, so if you want to formulate a question and then maybe take two or three and John can just ponder them and then give a response. So there are a couple of mics going around.
Just let me explain that this is Q&A, ladies and gentlemen. So it's desperately inadequate for a very obvious reason. All I can do is respond off the cuff and tell you how I would begin to approach the question. And you'll not be satisfied. But if you're not satisfied, and if your question is a real one, you know, and not one of those just to test me, let's see what he knows. You'll soon discover I don't know very much. So you can forget questions like that. The real thing is when you go home, maybe unsatisfied with what I've said, and you do the work to answer your own question, you'll never forget the answer to it. So I'm going to write down a few. Keep them on the topic, please. I'm not here to talk about Trump, for instance.
Great. Okay, behind you.
Thanks, John. I'm just interested in your view of what is, I think is a mathematical conundrum. People debating about whether God created the laws of mathematics and we're discovering them, or do you think we are just formulating the laws in the best way we can to describe the universe, but they keep changing because we are making them up?
Thank you. Number two. There's a whole host of hands here.
I do have a question, but I do actually think it's
To me, it's a miracle to hear a mathematician talking in terms of common sense, not logic. But my question is that applying that common sense logic to the first few pages of the Bible, how should we approach that? You know, versus the view that as a Christian you should believe everything in the Bible.
So early Genesis, yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Number three.
Excellent talk. I'd like to hear more philosophers brought up in sermons in church. But anyway, one of my heroes, I totally agree with the miracle thing that Hume said. I do respect the blessed Hume very much. Induction and cause and effect, I think he still has something to say. Bearing that in mind, that science is predicated on physical observation of the universe, and there's that logical construct that it's an inductive and to some extent deductive process. So we make the assumption that if it applies to one experiment, it will apply to others.
Yes.
You would concur with that. Is it possible that miracles could happen without breaking the laws? And I say that in inverted commas because that's our sort of... a miracle could happen without breaking the laws of physics as we understand them at this stage. Is that possible?
Okay, four... See, this is a brilliant way of dealing with questions. I just keep on asking them until the time's up. And then I run. Okay, let's take one more at the moment.
Hi, John. So Genesis describes a world in which death did not exist until mankind sinned. God described the world before the fall as good, meaning it could not contain death. And the fall is fundamental to the gospel and Christian faith. The origin of species and mankind by natural selection requires death prior to the fall. How then can one believe in evolution by natural selection and be a Christian? And to what extent can we reconcile Darwin and the gospel?
That's five questions. So we'll stop there for a moment. Okay, well, thanks for the questions. Is mathematics invented or is it created? Absolutely. I think it's both. Think about it. There was a famous mathematician called Pal Erdős, who wrote over 1,000 papers, and he was a marvelous chap. He travelled the world with a little suitcases, and he would knock at the door of a mathematician, say he arrived in London, knock at the door of King's College, really knock at the door of a mathematician at home, and he would stand there and he would say, "My mind is open." And inevitably, the person who lived in the house got a co-authored paper out of it. So everybody was delighted if Pal Erdős turned up. And he used to say of the results, "They're in the book." In other words, he was a kind of mathematical Platonist, believing that there was a realm of ideas where mathematics was all in God's book, so to speak. And the other side of it is that human beings are made in the image of God, and God's a creator. And he has made us to be creative in terms of art, and I believe mathematics and science and so on. So I think some things probably adhere to the very essence of the universe. And that raises big questions. Why is mathematics so brilliantly effective in describing the universe? There seems to be something built in there. But mathematicians have gone way beyond that kind of mathematics and created all kinds of mathematics. Some of it has proved to be applicable. Some of it has proved to be not applicable in that sense. So I can't answer the question except by saying it seems to me it's not one or the other. God, the creator, has built a universe that operates on recognizable laws and not on others. But he's enabled us to think not only about those laws, but of all kinds of extensions and variations, and to think abstractly in terms of mathematics. Now, the third question had to do with David Hume, of whom I was critical, but I'm not entirely critical of him, as you are. Though, I think one of the very interesting things about what he wrote on the matter of cause and effect was that he didn't really believe in causality. And so one of the huge problems with his statement that miracles are a violation of the laws of nature is he didn't really have the intellectual equipment on which to base the concept of a law of nature, which also Flew pointed out, and there's been quite a lot of recent work on this. Now, the induction problem is a very real problem. You've probably all heard of the inductivist turkey, and it's a good time to speak about inductivist turkeys at Christmas. You see, the turkey was fed on day one, and on day two, and on day three, and was also fed on day 364. And it therefore logically expected, on the basis of induction, to be fed on day 365. But it became food on day 365 because it became a Christmas dinner. And the point being that no matter how often a thing has happened in the past, to say it must happen in the future is to assume something about the universe that all those experiences do not add up to. David Hume, where I have found him useful, and in fact so useful that one of the books out there, Gunning for God, investigates at the end the resurrection through his eyes. Now, what do I mean by that? He not only wrote on the laws of nature and induction, he wrote about criteria for witnesses. Why should we believe anything? And I decided, since I'd heard it so often, that I would do something a bit different. I haven't found it elsewhere. And that is, use his criteria to investigate the strength of the argument for the resurrection. And I found them extremely useful. So there's a plus point for David, all right? I just want you to go home happy, you see, on this. Now, two questions about Genesis. And they could take a long time to answer, but I'm not going to take a long time to answer them. Common sense on the early chapters of Genesis. And this is a huge question for many people, not so much in this country, but very much so in America. That a superficial impression, and I mean it's superficial as I shall try to establish in a moment, is that Genesis is talking about a young earth and a young universe. And of course, the standard model says the universe is about, 13.8 billion years old, and the Earth is about 4-point-something billion years old. And some people argue, and here must be careful, because you see, let me confess to you, ladies and gentlemen, I come from a place called Armagh in Northern Ireland. Have you ever heard of it? Because there was a very famous archbishop there called Usher. And he wrote to the Vice Chancellor of Cambridge saying, "Dear sir, I have calculated that Adam was born on October the 5th, 4004 BC at about 9 o'clock in the morning, but I can't give it more accurately to you than that." And of course, his notions have circled the world and become part of some reference Bibles. So what do we make of all of this? Well, I'll tell you what I make of it. And what I make of it depends on reading very carefully what Genesis says. What does it say? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's the introduction. And the earth was without form and void and so on. And then there's a sequence of 6 days. Do you remember those days? And each one of them begins with, "And God said, let there be light," day one. "And God said, and God said, and God said." 6 days, and then a seventh day of rest. Well, I thought I would write to the professor of Hebrew at Cambridge. And to just check that, I thought I would speak to the professor of Hebrew at Oxford. And you know, they agreed. And they told me, in the words of Jack Collins, who's a scientist by training and one of the world's top Hebrew experts, he's the one behind the English Standard Version translation. He said, "You know, there are two past tenses in Hebrew. And the introduction to Genesis, verses 1 and 2, are in one past tense. and the 6 days are in another past tense. What does that mean? It means that the events described in the first two verses occur at an indefinite period of time before the 6 days. You see, in the beginning is not part of day one. Every day begins, and God said. There's no, and God said, let there be a universe, day one. Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? Now, I'll say this carefully. No matter what you believe about the days, they do not fix the age of the universe. So what does the Bible say about it? Nothing. So common sense, using your term, based on language, would tell you that the Bible says nothing about the age of the universe. End of that controversy completely, as far as I'm concerned. It's so sad when I find Christians fighting about something that is utterly unnecessary. Now you say, what do you think about the days? But mercifully, you didn't ask that question. But here's a bit of shameless advertising. I get this question so often, I've written a book about it. And it's called 7 Days That Divide the World. And if you want to know anything about it, have a look at that, because this second question that deals with death before the fall and all this kind of thing, I go into that in some detail. But I'm going to make one point to be fair to the questioner. You said there was no death before the fall, but just a minute, what kind of death? There certainly was plant death. Did the whales, when they were created, forgive my crudeness, did they swallow other fish? You see, the text, the crucial text in the New Testament, which concerns you and concerns me, is, for as through one man sin entered into the world, and death through sin, and so death passed upon all what? Human beings. Animals aren't mentioned. Now, what I believe is what Paul said, that human death is a consequence of the fall. I think the rest of it is an open question. So, again, I explore that in my little book as best as I can. So where does that leave us? Oh, the Hume question had another little bit. Pardon me, sir. You did say more. Could miracles happen without breaking the laws of physics? Well, what I was saying is they do. Miracles do not break the laws of physics. Now, if you want to pursue that anymore, let me refer to the works of Daniel von Wachter, who is a German philosopher but writes in English. He's written quite a lot of very interesting stuff recently on the question of miracles and the laws of nature, but I'm not going to go into that in any detail. Have we time for a couple more questions?
Yes. So let's get this side. A few, couple more questions, a couple of answers.
Hello.
Sorry about that.
It's not working.
Turned on. My question is, why, if there's so much evidence on the about that there's a creator and everything, that science has limitations, why do people still believe that that the world did come from nothing?
Well, that's very hard to answer. You need to ask them. But you see, the biblical claim is that it came from nothing. It came from nothing physical, just to repeat the point I made. But God is not nothing. And what I'm suggesting to you is that many of these scientists claim they have solved the problem. But they've solved it by redefining nothing so it isn't nothing anymore. It just isn't nothing. So they haven't solved their own problem. And that is becoming increasingly evident. So as far as I'm concerned, the biblical understanding of it is that the universe came from nothing physical, but it came from God, who is not nothing, but he is spirit. He's not physical. And our problem in our contemporary world is, at least in the West, that we're dominated by naturalism that says the only kind of stuff is eventually physical stuff, mass energy. There is no supernatural dimension. There is no spirit. But if you are open to the concept that there might be more to this universe, particularly if you think about your own mind, there is mind stuff. And if that's not reducible to physical stuff, then your mind, as Lewis pointed out years ago, is supernatural. That's a fascinating idea. You don't have to start with the resurrection to believe in the supernatural. The very fact that we can think, if you explain it naturalistically, it leads to nonsense because it undermines rationality. So it's supernatural. So every one of us has a little outpost of the supernatural in us. We have another one, of course. God has set eternity in our hearts. Okay, is there another one?
Last question.
I'd like to ask, what does... Okay, what does the Bible say about science?
What does the Bible say about science? Some very good things. It started it. How did that happen? Well, think about it. The Genesis story. Now, let me step back from that. Clearly, the Bible is not a textbook of science. I have never taught algebra from Leviticus, nor will I ever do so. And I don't think Simon will ever do that either. But, now here's the problem. And it's a great question to end on. Because many people think the safe way to cope with our topic is Bible and religion over here, science over there, and don't mix them. The late Stephen Jay Gould called that they are non-overlapping magisteria, bodies of teaching, science and theology, if you like. But that won't work. Because the statement, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, what universe is that a statement about? The universe that physicists and chemists and the rest of us study. There is overlap. But the Bible is dealing largely with the big why questions of existence, not with the how questions of how your heart works, if you see what I mean. But there is overlap, and the overlap is extremely important, particularly in early Genesis, because it tells us those days, by the way, and God said, that's the most important part of them. Our universe is the consequence of a series of speech acts where God spoke. That is the exact opposite of an unguided random process. But now, science itself. According to the Genesis record, God brought the animals to Adam and said, you name them. Taxonomy is the fundamental academic discipline in every field. Naming things. That's how science works. And God said, you do it. Now, why is that interesting? Because in Genesis, God names about five bits of the universe. I don't know whether you've ever noticed that. Earth, heaven, sky, yes, sea. But God didn't name all the rest of it. He said, you do it. So we've got a mandate to do science in the sense of naming things, exploring. We not only have a mandate to do science, but we've a mandate to explore and develop. Because the story of the Garden of Eden, it says there were four rivers going out of it. And if you follow one of them down, you'll find there's gold in that land and the gold is good. What's that about? It's about human curiosity. It's telling us about a fundamental ingredient of life. Explore. So that God is pro-science. And that resonates beautifully with me, with Newton, Galileo, Kepler, Clark Maxwell, and all the rest of them. So, ladies and gentlemen, in conclusion, at that level, we can be really comfortable in bringing science and faith in God together. And my final point is this, and it's a crucial point. Science not only cannot explain everything, science is not coextensive with rationality. Otherwise, you'd have to shut half the faculties at every university in the world. There'd be no literature, there'd be no languages, there'd be no history, and so on. Because the danger is that people begin to think that only the natural sciences are rational. That's nonsense. And Christianity, in that sense, is a rational belief system that brings evidence to bear. And one of the reasons I'm a Christian sitting here today is not because I go against my science, it's because of my science. I am not happy to swallow a theory that invalidates the work I've done in mathematics. And that's what atheism does, as far as I'm concerned. And secondly, we can apply the canons of rational thought. The Christian faith is open to that. And the reason I sit here is this. I've spent my entire life opening myself vulnerably to criticism and befriending people that do not share my worldview, because like you, I want to be sure, and I believe it is possible to be sure. So thank you very much indeed.